Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. This is episode 45. This week I'm joined by Bob Nastanovich of Pavement and the Silver Jews. We talk about the beginning and ending of the 90s most important and interesting independent band. Thank you so much for listening. Hey everybody, thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. This week is our landmark 45th episode with my man, the legend, Bob Nastanovich of Pavement. We talk a whole bunch about the whole alternative landscape of the 90s. We talk about, obviously, the beginning and the end of Pavement. Talk about Bob's other awesome band, the Silver Jews. If you don't know them, check them out. Whole bunch of good stuff to talk about. It was a long time to get him on the show, but it was definitely worth the wait. Bob's a great guy, and it's an awesome interview. Yeah, but before we get into the meat of it, I'd like to just talk about what's up in the world of Andy Dare right now. Every Friday, you can hear me on the Kevin Matthews Show. I do a little new segment, Talking Tunes with Andy. And we're just talking music, just bringing up some album reviews, stuff like that. Just a couple minutes every Friday, but just like to get my name out there a little bit. And you can find that show. It's a podcast. They got off the, you know, terrestrial radio thing, and they did their own thing by starting a podcast. He's on the Steve Dahl Network, and you can find all their shows at dahl.com. That's dahl.com. Please subscribe. It works out to being about the price of your morning cup of coffee for awesome shows. You get the Steve Dahl Show, you get the Kevin Matthews Show, and you also get an XQ101 DJ, James Van Osdell. I'm actually going to be talking to James pretty soon, having him on my show, so I'm pretty excited for that. Kevin Matthews' show is awesome. If you remember the 90s and the 80s with, you know, his character Jim Shorts, Darnell, all sorts of funny stuff going on the Kevin Matthews show. Just so glad to be part of it, and would definitely recommend it to anybody that's interested in comedy podcasts. So that is the Kevin Matthews show every Friday. I'm also on There Will Be Spoilers. It's hosted by Matt Fondelier of Ace Broadcasting. He produces the Adam Carolla Show, does a lot of work on Carolla's network as well. He's a great guy. He's got a movie podcast called There Will Be Spoilers, and I'm on, it was last week's episode, but it's obviously still up to download. Check it out. We talked 1994 movies, which was a banner year for movies. We also talk about Chicago movies, because I guess out there I'm kind of known for the Midwest, the Chicago accent, all that sort of stuff. So we got into a whole bunch of good movies based around Chicago. Otherwise, yeah, I got my USB drives. You can buy them for $5. That's on my Fiverr page. That's Fiverr.com, that's Fiverr.com, /Andy Dare. And you can get the $5 USB drive. It features every episode from 2011 on a little handy thumb drive. Get that for $5, or you can also be mentioned on the next episode of the Andy Dare Show, once again, for just $5. It's a really cool website, you know. You just state something that you can do for somebody for $5, and you'd be surprised about all the people that'll hit you up for it. So yeah, before we get into the awesome interview with Bob Nastanovich, I'd like to bring up my awesome sponsors. First up, we got the Man Grate. I know grilling season is coming right around the corner. If you want to achieve steakhouse quality burgers, fish, and chicken, go ahead and get yourself the Man Grate. It's a huge chunk of Detroit steel that fits over your existing grill grate. And the existing grill grate they usually give you is a little coat hanger-esque grate that really doesn't do much for the meat. You're basically cooking the meat with the heat off of the propane, and that's not what you want to do. It's similar to cooking your meat with a hairdryer. With the Man Grate, you're cooking through the convection of the steel. You're able to get those dark grill marks that you've always wanted. So why not pick yourself up a Man Grate for this awesome grilling season coming right around the corner? And by Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue in Westmont, Illinois. They're a family-friendly restaurant family-owned and operated since 1997. Really cool place. If you're in the western suburbs of Chicago, do check it out. It's the Real Deal Barbecue. They've got smokers attached to the building. Great beef brisket, pulled pork, you know, barbecued chicken, all sorts of good stuff. Homemade side dishes. What people sometimes don't know about Bub's is that they're also a full-service catering company. They've done something, I think last year they did something around 100 weddings. and they do all sorts of events. They do backyard pig roasts, you know, Hawaiian luaus. They do corporate events, corporate lunches. They deliver if you give them 72 hours notice. All sorts of catering, pig roasts, great times. If you want to impress your guests this summer and you want to show them the real deal barbecue, why not order some catering from Uncle Bub's Barbecue? You can find menus and more info at unclebubs.com. You can also give them a call at 630-493-9000 and stop by the restaurant. It's 132 South Cass Avenue in Westmont, Illinois. And by Secondhand Mall, located at 309 West Ogden Avenue, also in picturesque Westmont, Illinois. They are a secondhand shop that also recently bought out the whole inventory of Remember When Records, my lifelong record store, and they've rechristened it Record Utopia. And so they have a huge vinyl selection, huge CD selection. They got DVDs, movies, they've got video games, all sorts of different video games, electronics, computer equipment. They've also got power tools for the, you know, the carpenter in you. They've also got music instruments, a whole bunch of music instruments that a lot of people don't realize Secondhand Mall carries. So it's always a good time to go in there. They're a real relaxed environment, real nice guys. Tell them the Andy Dare Show sent you for savings and offers. And you can give them a call. They buy, sell, and trade. That's 630-810-9980. And check them out on the web. That's at secondhandmall.com, 2ndhandmall.com. All right. Without further ado, I would like to introduce you to my episode 45 interview with Bob Nastanovich of Pavement. Hey Bob, how's it going? You're on the Andy Dare Show.
Hey, it's great. It's great to be on the Andy Dare Show.
Awesome, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, where are you located?
I'm located right outside of Chicago, actually, in a suburb called Westmont, Illinois, about 15 minutes to the west of Chicago.
Oh, fantastic!
And you're out in Iowa, right?
Yeah, Des Moines, the big city.
Was it 90 degrees today? Or?
Yeah, when I was driving home, it was 88, so it was kind of melty. I actually turned on the air conditioner. Yeah, it was steamy, but it's supposed to get down to 40 degrees on Friday night. You know, it's that time of year. We had microbursts here the other night and about 70-mile-an-hour winds, and giant trees got ripped up all around the neighborhood, so that was pretty exciting.
Geez, yeah, I've been out to Iowa a couple times, and there's no trees older than like 5-10 years there because they just keep getting storms every, every spring. So,
yeah, no, we have some old ones, but they get spanked around pretty good.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, like Iowa, I think it's kind of similar to the suburbs on Chicago. It's like genuine, like nice people. You know, you don't have the attitudes of L.A. and New York. Am I right about that?
No, I would not compare this place to L.A. or New York very accurately. People are very large.
They're large, huh? Well, that's the same thing we got over here in Wisconsin, obviously. Some large ladies, some heifers, but yeah, they're genuine people.
Fine, yeah. Oh, very genuine. Yeah, no, it's great to be here. We've been here for about, 5 years now, just a little over 5 years exactly.
That's awesome. And you're doing the horse racing really business, right?
Yeah, I work at Prairie Meadows, the racetrack here, which is about 12 miles, actually towards Chicago from Des Moines. It's it's one of these modern racinos, which is a horse racetrack with a large casino attached to it. And the horse racing, you have to wear a lot of hats. So I do a lot of things here during the racing season. Have about 6 or 7 jobs, and it's a pleasure to work in an industry that you enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. Like I would always like to go to the OTB myself. I think that would be something I would totally be interested in. But like, is there like similarities to the music business, or is it just completely a different world?
Pretty different. Very few people. I mean, certainly from indie rock, very few people in this industry I've ever heard, in fact, I've probably come across maybe three people in all my years in horse racing that have ever heard of pavement, you know?
Oh, geez, huh? Okay.
You know, their idea of rock is more along the lines of like Allman Brothers or...
Or Molly Hatchet, yeah.
Warner or Garth Brooks or something.
I got you. Yeah. Nice.
A lot of Wranglers.
So I'm speaking with Bob from Pavement and Silver Jews, obviously. Been in the business over 20 years, obviously. Started with the early band Ectoslavia with David Berman and Steve, right?
Yeah, mostly. Steve was sort of a guest player in Ectoslavia. We were just a jam band that drank too much beer at $1.99 a six-pack in those days and made noise with metal percussion and cheap guitar amps in a basement. And actually, David sort of streamlined Ectoslavia and fired both me and Steven out of it at one stage. And it was interesting. That band actually played places as far away as Blacksburg. I think they had about 10 shows, and there's, you know, a lot of different groupings. It was sort of a very weakly made, unknown noise band from Charlottesville, Virginia, basically completely lacking significance.
That's sweet. Like, is David Berman, has he always been the eccentric, or I don't really picture him as a rock star, really. He doesn't really look for the limelight. Am I correct with that?
Well, I mean, in a typical definition of the rock star, but in a lot of ways, he's always been a rock star to us. He's, you know, very intelligent. Obviously has his eccentricities. He was kind of in the mold of an attractive goth in college.
Really?
Huh. And he was always, you know, he was into a lot of things, but when he was high school, he was very much into Robert Smith and The Cure and, you know, sort of darker things. He was actually sort of, you know, definitely the biggest sort of classic rock star of all of my friends in college. You know, he's a tall fellow, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And, but his writing talent has always been his most intimidating feature.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say like Dylan-esque, but some of those lyrics are just completely from, it seems like it's from a psyche that's unstable. And that's, I usually look for that when I'm trying to find good lyrics, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a very accurate description. he's definitely whack. But, you know, I mean, he basically, you know, I've known him since I was 18, and from the very beginning, he was definitely interested in making something of his life from a creative standpoint. I mean, he's, you know, most of us just, I think we're sort of goofing around, and David sort of knew at a very young age that he wanted to be a writer and pursued that pretty aggressively. And really from the start had a tremendous amount of success in the writing program at Virginia and earned the respect of his professors from, you know, the age of 18 on. And,
really?
Yeah, no, he was pretty well known in at that school, you know?
Sure.
And deservedly so. I mean, he is an unusual talent and very gifted person. I think he should be proud of himself as we near our mid-40s that he actually, you know, has applied a talent and a method that he's comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, like albums like Starlight Walker, American Water, those are going to be things that people go back to and back to for years to come. How about like a similarity between...
You know, Actual Air and, you know, his books are, you know, they...
Sure.
Hopefully there'll be more to come.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be. How about like similarities between like Malcolmus and Berman? It seems like they're pretty two pretty different guys, right?
Yeah, very much so. From the start, you know, Steven is more, personality-wise, there was always a bit of a conflict there. You know, Steven's from California, and Steven's sort of like a classic sports fan. They didn't have too many similarities. They sort of binded together over the years due to the fact that they were able to develop a cohesiveness based on their unusual talents, you know.
Sure.
But at first they were just kind of like that. I mean, there was never that much animosity, and there's certainly always a mutual respect. And then after a certain amount of time, there was sort of the, you know, it's just like all talented people when they get together, and sometimes it makes it impossible for them. There's quite a bit of competition between the two.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
How about the reason that the Jews never hit the road, or they didn't hit it till 2006?
I think David really felt in order to finish off the Silver Jews that he had to do a tour, and it was a very unnatural thing for him to do and a very difficult thing for him to do because he'd seen so many bands and seen so many of his heroes over the years and respected like really good live performance and was almost intimidated by it and didn't want to present Silver Jews in a shabby manner or sort of expose himself as sort of a non-musician. So I think the whole experience was very stressful for him. And Silver Jews, probably because of Pavement and how busy we were for so long, I think David wanted to sort of protect that it was sort of more of a secretive, you know, sort of a furtive mission.
Sure.
Not really necessarily a project, but unique in that it was a band that didn't do the usual rigmarole.
Yeah, it was kind of like always shrouded in mystery. That's what I kind of like was drawn to about them. And on Pavement, on the other hand, you guys went for the golden ring kind of, during the 10 years you guys were together. How about like being courted by the majors with Pavement? Was that something that was pretty uncomfortable? Did you guys ever think about accepting one of those big, whatever you call it, signing on a contract for these majors?
Nobody really that approached us had any significant appeal.
Sure.
We were really, really fortunate in Pavement because a lot of the people that we work with, whether it be Drag City or Matador or Billions, which is our booking agent, they were all sort of like-minded and the same age and sort of growing at the same rate, started out at about the same time. People that we could really relate to because they were sort of in our same age group and that they weren't, you know, you talk directly to the people that,
sure,
were in charge. I actually didn't experience it too much. It was sort of a little bit overblown with Pavement, like actual, like definitive approach by certain people, like hypothetically, whether it be like Capitol or Geffen or something like that. I don't really personally remember too much interaction, probably because I wasn't on the business manager end of Pavement. I wasn't really that interested in it because I didn't really have any power in that regard.
Sure.
I think Scott probably saw more of that than the rest of us. But the most important thing is that it was really easy to work first with Drag City and then with Matador, and then we started touring. I mean, we were one of the first bands that Botch Billions had over, you know, Billions in Chicago, and now he's got a roster of like 300 or so bands. I mean, he's one of the biggest forces in the music industry today.
And he's still working with Steve, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And, he's great. You know, he's a great booking agent and, you know, he played a significant role in everything we did, you know, and, you know, same goes with Drag City and then with Matador. It was just always very comfortable. Our deals were very straightforward, very easy to grasp. We never felt like we were getting ripped off. And, you know, you kind of always, to be basic about it, you just feel like you're working with cool people that not only completely grasp what Pavement and Silver Jews wanted to do, but cared about exactly how it was done. So you just didn't feel like a lot of bands feel like, you know, their control of their little project, which they started in their little town that they cared so much about in their 20s, was being like handed over to a bunch of people that didn't really grasp what it was all about.
Yeah, a guy in a suit drinking Pepto-Bismol or something. He didn't have to deal with that too much through these guys, you know?
Right, that kind of thing. And you just feel like you're not, I mean, I think that it ruined a lot of bands that, you know, would have been great. And also, you know, you're signing over your project and it was just always nice to be keenly aware of, you know, why you made, you know, this amount of money and how, you know, as opposed
sure.
to things getting confusing. Things were just really simple. So then, and sort of in hindsight, it's worked out because, you know, we have pretty decent deals in regards to our royalties, you know, still today. So it's just, you just feel like, you know, there's fair treatment on all ends.
That's awesome. And I mean, Steve's still with them. They put out your greatest hits in 2010. Are we going to be seeing some of the old albums get reissued, you know, with like, or, oh, actually they've already all been reissued. Am I correct? Except for Terror
Everything
Twilight?
Except for the no Terror Twilight, but I don't really know what's going on with that. Like, you know, you would know sort
sure.
of, you know, not because I'm like intentionally left out in the dark. It's just because if, you know, it doesn't really matter to me. You know, I mean, I'd be more than happy if they decide to. I mean, I've been satisfied with all the re-releases. I think they're sort of fine. And I mean, whether if it was left totally up to me, whether I would have made those decisions, I'm not really sure. You sort of would have had to explain to me why you would want to do it. I guess because there was a lot of material on the cutting room floor at each of those recording sessions that they thought that serious Pavement fans might be interested in, and they were able to gain exposure to that material. So I guess that would be the reason why you would do it. But,
yeah, I think that's a good thing. I mean, there was an embarrassment of riches on that on the new Slanted Enchanted reissue, and like a lot of those EPs were all like poor, like, you know, not domestic. They're hard to find. So I think a lot
right.
of people were able to hear some of the songs for the first time.
So. Yeah, that's cool. In regards to Slanted Enchanted, I think, you know, since it was sort of Pavement's most groundbreaking album.
Sure.
And, you know, I think sort of the one that, even though it sounds fidelity-wise, probably doesn't, I mean, it sounds, you know, it just doesn't sound like it's, and it was made on a 15-track recording studio in a guy's garage in Stockton, California, you know, so.
And that was just Steven, Scott, and Gary, right? That was just the trio of them?
That's correct. Huh. Yeah, Mark and I didn't plan anything until Watery Domestic came out.
Gotcha.
So all the way through Watery Domestic, and then after from Watery Domestic on, Mark played on just about everything, and I didn't play at all on Crooked Rain. I was in Louisville at the time that was made.
Oh, I get
you. Actually, I remember picking up Steven in New York and driving him to Louisville, and it's like a 12.
Jeez.
Howard drives to Louisville, and he played all the songs on Crooked Rain for me for the first time, and we sort of discussed what I would do when I would play them when we eventually play it live. That was kind of cool. I remember that trip.
Yeah, that would be pretty mind-blowing hearing those on in the car, you know, for the first time.
Yeah, that's that, you know. I mean, all, you know, the things you hear about Pavement, like, you know, San and Chandler's, like, you know, a year that it was sort of being shopped around, and basically we just had a really cheap cassette deck that made tape to tape, and, you know, we would make copies of the cassette and sort of mail them out to, you know, small labels that we thought were cool.
Sweet.
And it was nice that, you know, in Matador, you know, Steven and I were living in the northern part of New Jersey, and so it was very easy to gain access and get to know the people at Matador. And it was, you know, it was great to be one of the first bands on that label. And, you know, I think we had no problems at all with Drag City. I think that the most significant thing was, it was just nice to have a record label that was right, you know, near where we lived. That was actually a significant factor in the switch from Drag City to Matador.
Cool. And Drag City was in Chicago at the time, or still is, right?
Oh yeah, always has been. Yeah, always has been. I mean, it's grown a little bit, but not much.
Here's a weird one. Have you guys ever met Steve Albini from Chicago? Or?
I've never met Steve Albini yet. I've always understood from the very start that he did not like Pavement at all. So
I've heard otherwise. I've heard that he respects you guys. I mean, now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't really care what Steve
Albini.
I
mean,
I think he's done a lot. And he's made a lot of really cool records, and he's a very good studio engineer. And that's enough for me. I mean, I have a lot of mutual friends with him.
He had like a horrible like reputation before I went and did an interview at his electrical audio in Chicago. He had a horrible like rep that preceded him, but he couldn't have been a nicer, more down to earth, just chill guy. So it was totally like, I don't know what to believe on Steve, you know?
Well, he says a lot of mean things, you know, which, and he's sort of, you know, he's an authority figure, and which he's deserved because of his body of work. But I have a lot of mutual friends. I mean, all the members of Slant.
Paho.
You know, come to mind, Britt especially. And I don't have any. I interviewed Steve Balbini when I was in college after a Rape Man show in 1988 for a fanzine with my friend Gate, and he was perfectly polite to us. He didn't want to have anything to do with David. He was disturbed by David's appearance for some reason.
Really?
I think he just looked at David and saw him as an overzealous
sort of pious
asshole. Yeah. I can't really figure out what's going on, but no, he's I respect him, but I don't really, you know, I don't care.
Don't really
it's
care.
It's like Henry Rollins' hate statement, you know.
You don't have a horse in that race.
I like Black Flag just fine, you know, and you know, I can't listen to the Henry Rollins band myself, you know. But you know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, there's these people that are, you know, powerful, famous, and influential people from the genre before Pavement. And, you know, if they think if Pavement makes them sick, then that's fine with me. It just rubs them the wrong way, or, you know, they don't like something about the band's attitude. I mean, Henry Rollins' case, he was offended by the slacker ethic, whatever that was. And I think Steve Albini, quite frankly, just thought we were overrated, the same way that, like, you know, David Yao would. And David Yao's a good friend of ours. You know, he just...
He thought you guys were overrated?
Yeah, he never really... He just didn't think we were very good, which is, you know, fine with me. I don't care. I mean, I love him, and I love his band, and he likes us as people.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's what matters.
The music comes down at the end of the day to, like, a matter of taste. I mean, I've never understood why there's so many Pavement fans that, you know, their two favorite bands are Pavement and Guided by Voices. I've never really seen the connection there, other than I guess it's, you know, fairly similarly made guitar-based rock music.
It's back when you used to get, like, the Matador catalog. You'd probably see those two names together, and then they'd order together, and that's how, I don't know, maybe that's how the seeds were planted between those two. But you're very different, I mean.
Oh, yeah, no, to me they are, you know, in every way, shape, and form, you know.
Have you ever met Robert Pollitt? I'm sure you have. Is he a nice guy, or is he just an old drunkard?
We played a lot of shows with them. They opened up for us a lot. I'd say maybe, if I had to guess, maybe 15 times. Huh. And it didn't really say too much with him. He sort of, I don't know how he does things. I don't really know. We had to guard our beer. They had this reputation as that they would steal beer.
Sure.
And, but they just, you know, they were generally polite. You know, I just think that guy wanted to derive some energy and get some energy and focus off of, creating a rivalry between the bands. It didn't really matter to us. I mean, I think in Pavement, they're Guided by Voices fans, and people, you know, there are people that think they're a pretty cool band and have a couple records, and there are people that have, you know, a lot of Guided by Voices records. I'm sort of pretty indifferent to them. I think their drinking ability is overrated.
Yeah. It's more about them being prolific. I mean, he's written, you know, thousands of songs or whatever, but
pretty. Guy's got an impressive body of work. And
yeah.
You know, when we played, when I saw him the other day in 2010 at that Matador thing, they certainly delivered the goods for their fans.
Sure.
And I think that's something that they always did. So I think they deserve a lot of credit. for that.
Definitely.
I don't reach when I reach for something in the G section. It's usually Gang of Four or something.
Nice. I'm trying to get Andy Gill actually. Yeah. So
good guy.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I really like Gang of Four, especially Entertainment. But I'm reading Perfect Sound Forever, the book now. I hadn't seen the book. I mean, it's been out for, 8 years? But I just went to Powell's in Portland last year and picked up, a stack of used books, got that. And it's a really interesting read. How about you guys? What do you think is the most closest to a Perfect Sound that you guys achieved? Like maybe like your favorite Pavement album or favorite song?
I always like Trigger Cut. That was a good Pavement song. I mean, if you're playing early Pavement, then... I mean, Watery Domestic is a really good record. I think that there's a lot of... I think the most important thing about... Well, the way I sort of look at bands is over your entire recorded output, whether it's one CD or 25 CDs, is that if you've made 10 good songs, you're a really, really good band. And if you've made, more than 25, then you're a great band.
Sure.
And Matt and I would like to think that we've made 25 great songs. So
easy. Yeah.
I think from, really before Sand and Enchanted, a lot of that material all the way through to Terror Twilight, I think there's a lot of good Pavement songs. I like that song, So Stark You're a Skyscraper, I think there's a lot of, my mother was telling me the other day that she saw Coldplay on Austin City Limits, and she watched the entire thing, and she was, as she was watching it, she was sort of comparing it to Pavement, and what stood out to her is that our songs were, a lot better, which I found pretty interesting from the eyes of obviously biased, but at the same time, she was never a huge Pavement fan like my father. And she was always interested in it, but over a period of years, she sort of gained an appreciation for the songs.
Pavement had the songs to back up everything, and Coldplay's more like an artifice, like a cool looking dude with a stud in his ear and just, a lanky English Brit who's good looking and stuff more than this. I think you guys had way better songs.
Yeah, obviously they're always going to have a greater appeal, like a lot of bands do, but in terms of being popular. But, hopefully, you look back at it as being the 90s, basically Pavement's existence was the 90s. And, that's a decade. It was a pretty significant decade. And
a period of a growth for everybody, it seemed like,
Yeah, no, great. So, to be, considered a significant part of that, or... sorry, I have allergies this time of year. Sorry about the sniffling.
Don't worry.
I'm happy with it. And, 2010, I was a little bit apprehensive about sort of not doing things properly. And I think in the end, I'm not ashamed of it. I thought that we had a very good time. And, the most important thing is made a lot of people who wanted to see the band that didn't get to see the band happy. And I guess that was sort of the goal.
Yeah, you definitely hit that goal. How about doing Terror Twilight? And was it Steve who brought in the Nigel Godrich production, or was that the record label?
I'm not really sure. I don't know. Yeah, I just don't know. I just know that before we went to record that, there's going to be this producer guy, and he'd been extremely successful in his brief career, and he showed up, and it was interesting, he had a sort of a different approach. We never really worked with anybody like that. I thought it was just a sort of a new adventure as opposed to like a desperation move.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And so he was fine. He did a fine job. He cared a lot. He tried to jump in really quick and figure out what it was all about. He was very sincere. I think he did his best, I think that, Terror Twilight is a great album. I don't have, I'm very happy with it. And, I think that, you know, it's really difficult to jump into a band that's and start working with a band that's established and making their fifth record, and you know, just they've never met before, and then you're sort of conscious of not wanting to be a part of the first bad Pavement record.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a tough spot for him to be in, and I think he tried his absolute hardest, and we had to move studio at the start of it. We sort of intended to make it one place, and he couldn't really work with the equipment that was in there, so we had to regroup and move to another sort of more modern studio, and that was sort of a drastic move right in the middle of it. But, you know, all the songs on that record are Stevens, which is different from the other records, and
Did Scott have songs for that one, or was it going to be known that it was just Steve's songs, or did Scott have a couple songs?
He was behind. His songs were just behind in terms of development, and you know, we sort of got to a point where we were in a studio that was, you know, pretty expensive by our standards, and we didn't really want to waste too much time fleshing out songs, so we just kind of worked on the ones that were the farthest along. That's really sort of how it worked out. Steven was pretty aggressive with his material at that time. And
was being in the expensive studio kind of stressful and maybe part of the reason why you guys were on the verge of splitting at that point?
Mm. No, it was a sterile atmosphere. I mean, it was just different. The split base was sort of based more upon the fact that Steven was, you know, getting frustrated with the combination of, he just felt that there was some lack of effort on it from his bandmates in terms of musical acumen and improving ourselves and working during the downtime between records and sort of honing in and listening to the same stuff that he was listening to. His song structures are starting to get more complex. I think he just felt the need. I think he felt like he was sort of trapped in Pavement at the time, sort of limited, and there's only so much that he could do with the four people that he'd been working with for several years. And, you know, and that led to the Jicks. I mean, you know, technically they're more proficient musicians and Pavement, and that's the difference. So he was able to sort of phase into the Jicks sort of set him free a little bit from the mold, what he felt was like a mold of making Pavement songs. So you know, none of us had at the time, because we weren't keenly aware of it. You know, he was ahead of us from that standpoint, and you can't wake up one day and start being able to do certain things that you couldn't do before. I mean, we had a wide variety of talent levels in Pavement, and you know, not that all of us didn't bring something significant to the process, but I just think he felt like he needed to do something else. I think he felt like he'd done everything that he could do with Pavement over the course of five albums and over 10 years, and I think that, you know, before it started to suck, in his opinion, then he wanted to stop it and do something else.
Yeah, you guys had a great batting average. I mean, five albums, five hits out the park, pretty much. Do you consider the Jicks to be a continuation of Pavement at all? I mean, you can't really like miss like Malcolmus's fingerprints on both Pavement and the Jicks. It seems like it's a kind of a continuation. And you tour managed for them for a while, right?
Yeah, they're a great band. I think that they're you know, a lot different. I mean, I think you take, you know, there's a lot of personality, obviously differences, different types of people. I think, yeah, whenever you have, I mean, Steven is the sort of main contributor to both, and that's sort of the likeness, but I think that's sort of where it ends. I mean, I think that, you know, Pavement has a different sort of appeal, a different sort of way of doing things. It's sort of less of a project in some ways, you know. And I mean, I've always thought, I mean, that, you know, there's definitely some Jicks songs, especially at the start, that were intended to be songs on, you know, what would have been a sixth Pavement record. So obviously there's you know, there's always going to be, you know, and I guess this most recent record Steven made, he had answered a lot of questions about that because people thought of all the Jix records, it was the one that sounded most like Pavement, you know.
I mean, yeah,
to me,
so.
It always sounds like, you know, to me, it always sounds like, you know, obviously he's got, you know, you can tell his voice from a mile away and his guitar tricks and tunings and stuff like that, you know, so.
Yeah, and the songwriting, yeah, too, I mean, he's got a very original style. I was kind of...
Yeah, his imprint on the record, it's unmistakable, his imprint, you know, so...
Sure.
But in terms of, like, ethics and approach and, you know, I just think it's... I mean, Pavement was... you know, I think he's sort of... You know, I don't really know how the Jix work these days, even though I know all the people and I like them all. I just think that, you know, he's... He dictates what's going on in that band a lot more than he did in Pavement, you know.
Sure, yeah. I like that he had Beck Hansen produce it. I was expecting, you know, like samples and weirdness a la Odelay or something. But pretty much it seemed like Beck was pretty hands-off, at least, and just got a pure, like, almost Back to the Garage sound for, like, Mirror Traffic. Do you like the album? Or?
I listened to it, like, I got it, you know. And I listened to it a handful of times. I thought it was very good.
Cool.
You know, coming off that Pavement year, it was a little, you know, it's always been a little difficult for me to listen to the Jix without thinking about how Pavement would have done that song and
sure.
how it would have been different or sort of comparing it. I just can't really get my head around it. So I can't really listen to it in a totally unbiased fashion. I'm just happy if it's successful and that not only Steven, but all the people in that band who have worked very hard to make it a success do well. I mean, that's all I care about, is that they, you know, that they do the things that they want to do, whether, you know, in regards to touring and videos and stuff like that. You know,
that's very cool. Yeah.
I mean, no matter what they do, I don't really feel like they could, you know, tarnish what Pavement did. But
no, that'd be real difficult to do that. Taking it back, how about
great,
like?
Band, you know,
oh, sure.
Great band. It's hard for me to listen to it without, you know, sitting there saying, "Oh well, you know."
I would do this
without comparing it to Pavement. You know.
Gotcha. How about, like, Taking It Back? You guys did a lot of Peel sessions, and you were in the studio for the Peel sessions. What kind of guy was John Peel?
He was great. I mean, he was a legend. He was just somebody that made a really significant impact on British culture. I mean, there's a lot of kids that would never have heard a lot of really obscure bands if it wasn't for his research and interest in putting them on national radio. I mean... He provided a service to, you know, the youth of Britain to be able to access interesting music from all over the world that they, you know, never would have heard. And actually that of course led to a lot of bands being able to go to Great Britain and tour. So he's a cultural icon. I mean, and a great guy, extremely polite, respectful. We played his birthday party. I can't remember what birthday it was in London, and that was a fantastic event. He was great. You know, I mean, I don't think it would be near impossible to have the same kind of figure have such a national impact in this country at any point in history. But I guess there has been. There's legendary American DJs, but so many kids, the first time they ever heard so many important things at a young age was on that radio show. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a one-man internet. That. Like, nowadays, everybody's a tastemaker. Everybody's putting out what they like to, you know, on social networking and whatever. But back then, I mean, he was like the conduit to try to, you know, get yourself out there. He broke the Slay Tracks EP to the radio, or is that true? Or?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, he was on it. I mean, he had a lot. That's a, you know, very, very obscure record, and he would somehow gain access to records like that from obscure corners of, you know, mostly Europe and the U.S. And, you know, because of that, like, you know, the wedding present covered Box Elder, which at the time was a big deal. I mean, they were a big underground band, and
sure.
You know, because they heard that on, or they bought it in their record store because they heard it on John Peel. So, you know, Pavement was always readily embraced in the UK. We were always sort of a bigger band from in the you know, because obviously because of our you know, influences, you know, very Anglo-centric influences in Pavement. We were always kind of grasped by the English. They always, you know, because they call it the sidewalk Pavement. I think that they think the Pavement is sort of a British word as opposed to an American word.
Really? Yeah.
And yeah, so I think that they're sort of they sort of felt that we were an American band that was made for you know, British people.
I always like reading NME and, like, you know, the Melody Maker and stuff like that. I like the band Blur a lot, so I thought it was really strange. I saw Blur at the Metro, just a tiny little place, when they were at the heat of their, or at the, you know, apex of their powers in like 96, and they played my little club like it was Wembley. And then it was really cool. Like a year later, they totally switched up their sound and said they were influenced by Pavement and Sonic Youth, and that totally, like, blew my mind, kind of.
That was pretty crazy, you know, none of us really saw that coming. You know, they were good. Steven was really good friends with Justine from Elastica, who was going out with Damon from Blur at the time.
Sure.
And they all hung out together a lot. I only met him, Damon, one time, and I was in Spain at the Benny Cassim Festival in the 90s. And
cool.
Never really met the rest of them. Nice guys.
That's awesome. Yeah.
They partied really hard.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. It's pub rock.
Yeah, a little bit too hard for their own good.
I gotcha. Nice. Well, yeah, like nowadays, I'm dealing with the podcast world and stuff like that. That's like the way that people are getting out there. It seems like everybody's got a podcast now. It's sort of weird, right?
You gotta jump in.
That's
what climate.
I think I'm a little bit ahead of my time. I mean, I could see, like, in 2 years, everybody doing this, but it's funny. I heard The Shins today on Mark Maron's, it's WTF podcast, it's called. I guess it's one of, like, the most downloaded in the country, and he's just going on and on about Pavement, and so is Mark Maron, just going on and on about Pavement, how much they love you guys. So.
Wow. That's very interesting. That's nice. I mean, it's nice to, I mean, you know, it was, I wasn't really readily aware of the magnitude of it until we went on tour in 2010, because, you know, when you live out here in Iowa, and there are Pavement fans here in Des Moines, there's, you know, a few dozen. It's always been very easy.
Yeah.
I know Pavement fans tend to be really polite, and so, no, it's great. I mean, it's, I don't really know how to feel about it, since I'm not really a songwriter.
Yeah.
I think that I personally am very well treated, in terms of Pavement and things that we did. I think that I definitely get as much or more credit than I deserve. So I'm cool with it. You know, it was a fantastic way to go through your 20s. It was a great experience. And just, you know, you think about, like, all the places that I was able to go. It was just a very enriching life experience. So I consider myself, you know, very fortunate in that regard. And I guess sort of when it ended in 99, you know, the most difficult thing about it for a couple of years was that you just, it was nerve-wracking, but it was extremely exciting. You sort of felt like you were part of something pretty important, and when we were successful on stage and felt like we'd done something good that we could be satisfied with, it was a pretty great feeling. So, you know, when those songs were performed live successfully, which sort of meant that they were molded in a different manner than the album, which I think the same, you know, a lot of bands change their songs when they create them live. But I think there were you know, we got to a point and throughout our career as a live performing band where, you know, we were able to do something unique and perform live and have it be sort of exciting and special on occasion. So that was, it's a pretty fantastic feeling, you know, and, it was great to be able to do that for, you know, the better part of 10 years and then that reunion tour. So it was very fond memories.
Awesome. Do you miss like the whole tour hustle, or is that something that was done when it was done and you're kind of happy to be over with?
I miss it. Yeah, I miss it. I miss the excitement. You know, I don't really need the praise per se, but just the, you know, the excitement of playing those songs and getting them right and knowing that the crowd, you know, who's come to see them, you know, generally would care quite a bit about them and be pretty excited about what they were seeing. That's a pretty good, deep, positive feeling. So I sort of, you know, I miss that vibe. And, you know, I miss my bandmates and I miss the guys that I toured with and miss the environment and miss the excitement. And, you know, a lot of the aspects of the traveling was exciting and, you know, it was exhausting, but I think that's the case with everybody. It's, you know, it's an exhausting experience, but no, I certainly wouldn't trade.
How about like any bands that are out there now that are newer that you got or that you're interested in or that, you know, sparked that interest in you that, you know, you might have wanted to tour with back in the 90s? Any new bands out there tickling your fancy?
I mean, I pay attention quite a bit to those scene. We actually have a scene here in Central Iowa in Des Moines, Ames and Des Moines. And there's some really good bands here. There's Derek Lambert is a really good musician. There's a band that we played a show in Kansas City with in 2010 called Poison Control Center. I have a new record to tour all the time. They're a really exciting band.
I heard of them.
There's a band from Ames. There's a band from Ames called Mumfords, which are really, really dynamic live show. They just played South by Southwest and they've got a newish album. There's a band called Seeds of Something and Manus Pinchers. There's actually kind of a cool little live scene going on here to sort of embrace.
That's
and they're
awesome.
All really nice kids. So, it's fun to sort of pay attention to what's going on at a local level and see what these kids do. Like, there's this live festival in Des Moines in July called 8035, and like, Mumfords are playing on it. They're just absolutely over the moon, you know, like, you know, they're so excited, like, you know, referring to it as the biggest day of their lives and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool to see kids get really excited.
Amped up, yeah.
About things, you know what I mean?
Cool.
But it's sort of on an international level, or, I mean, we played with some cool bands in 2010, but they're mostly people from our genre, you know, or people that we knew, you know, back then that were still working on projects. So, you know, I could definitely be more aware of what's going on. David sometimes will try to turn me on to current things and I'll listen to them. It's pretty easy to get on like YouTube or just basically Google a band name and be able to not only see them, but watch them.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about nowadays. Yeah.
Yeah, I can catch up in a hurry, you know. And but I'm interested. I don't really put in as much time as I probably should paying attention to what's going on today with the kids. So
yeah, that's true.
This time of year, I work like 65 hours a week in horse racing. And when I'm not working, I'm pretty much watching sports, you know. So, you know, and I go see bands. I go, there's a small indie club here in Des Moines called Vaudeville Muse, which is a really cool venue that holds about 200 people, and I DJ there a couple times a year and New Year's Eve and a couple other times, and I go see about a dozen shows there a year. I'm good friends with the young man, Lad Asklund, that books it, and he does a really good job. Like, and we get DRI is playing here next week, and he's got Mike Watt coming in August. Now, Iowa's a really tough place to book shows because you've got, obviously you have Chicago, but then, like, after bands play Chicago, they're either going to play Minneapolis, Omaha, Kansas City, or Des Moines. Well, obviously Des Moines is going to be the fourth choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even fifth, actually, behind Iowa City. Like, more bands are more likely to go to Iowa City than they are to Des Moines. So
even Champaign, yeah.
Yeah, and Champaign over there. No, so we're really, like, I always think it's amazing when bands do come here. And then when they do come here, if we get, like, 30 people to go, that's a big deal, or 50 people to go. That's like, Lemonheads played here in the winter, and there's probably, like, oh, I'd say maybe 250 or 300 people there for that. Like, Vaudeville Muse, which is a huge crowd, like, you know.
Packed,
and,
yeah.
There's not that many. I mean, there's a lot of people here, but just not that many people into. There's a lot of people into, like, death metal and, you know, satanic.
Slipknot, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's that, but there's, like, you know, that kind of, like, real underground, like, hardcore. You know, there's a lot of kids into that here. And there's definitely a little scene for that here. But it's a great place to live. I love living here.
Yeah, I think I just got, like, one more question for you. It's
okay.
Been a blast.
Cool.
Like, how about that scream that you developed when you were, being the auxiliary guy in Pavement? You developed quite that scream. I thought it was kind of Henry Rollins-esque. That's why it was funny that you mentioned him. Were you a fan of the hardcore punk in the early 80s? Or?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, those were a lot of my heroes. And I think that was my way of sort of feeling like I was trying to be rock. I think it was also, like, partly out of, like, true fear that, and it was also, like, a huge release of tension. So I would get really worked up and nervous, to some extent in a good way and to some extent in a bad way, to do those shows. And it kind of really freaked me out. I'd be really nervous about screwing up. And there was a lot of tension being released.
Sure.
With a scream, and I think if you can't sing, like I can't sing at all, I can't carry a tune at all, then if you're screaming, you don't really have to worry about that. But Steven, like, turned over, like, the more abrasive parts of his vocal performance to me live, so he didn't shred his voice.
Gotcha,
and,
save it.
Since I can't sing, and I had to scream, so it became a pavement trademark, and so be it, you know.
Most certainly.
I was just trying to be rock. I was trying to be rock, and I never really was that rock, but I was trying to be rock.
It was rock. It was definitely rock. And, man, I just want to thank you so much for, you know, taking the time out of your night. I mean, it's been a long time coming. I appreciate it, Bob.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrew. Best of luck with your show. I think it's an exciting thing to do. I hope that if you have ever, if there's anybody you ever want to get in touch to talk to, and I'll try to hook you up with them. You know, I mean, certainly people like, Steve West lives out in the country. He's always glad to talk about his musical projects. And
I would love it.
A bit of a tricky one.
That's what I figured that, yeah.
I mean, he's all right. You know, I mean, he's all right. You can get him to do it.
Is he going to start recording again?
Steven
or
lives in
what,
Germany
what?
Now. He lives in Berlin. So.
Really?
Yeah. Let's see. David is at home in Nashville, and he's working on stuff, you know, poetry, drawings, books, writing projects. He's been pretty busy lately. He's been on the internet a lot lately, which is good to see. And he's doing well.
Awesome.
He's doing pretty good. He loves me. He's a great friend. And, you know, there's – but now if I can help you out, just stay in touch, and then I'll try to get in touch with people for you so you can drive these other podcast DJs into the ground.
That's what I'm trying to do, slowly but surely. And
yeah.
I really appreciate your help, Bob. I appreciate you taking the time out. So, yeah, on behalf of Bob Nastanovich, this is Andy Dare signing off for The Andy Dare Show.
Be sure to follow Andy on Twitter. That's at Andy Dare, AndyDerer. And like the show on Facebook. That's facebook.com/TheAndyDareShow. Videos at youtube.com/AndrewMartinDare, and it all leads back to theandydareshow.com. Support our show by supporting our sponsors, Secondhand Ball, The Mandrake, and Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue. Thank you so much for listening.